85% of artists in major American art museum collections are white, and then 1.2% are black.
The general public is not aware of the contributions African-American artists had made to American culture in general.
David Driscoll, a professor of art at the University of Maryland, has organized this show called Two Centuries of Black American Art.
Had this black art exhibition not been organized, many of the artists who are shown here never would have been seen.
There are many kinds of museums in cities and towns all around the world. But this season, we're taking a closer look at one city, our city. In the spring of 1921, the thriving black community of Greenwood was destroyed in what came to be known as the Tulsa Race Massacre. 100 years later, we're still coming to terms with the trauma of those shameful days. But what role can museums and artists play in healing and reconciliation? From Philbrook Museum of Art, the Greenwood Art Project, and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential 2021. As an editor, producer, documentarian, and director, Sam Pollard has made an impact by sharing black stories. And that's putting it lightly. From editing many of Spike Lee's features, including Jungle Fever, Clockers, and Bamboozled, to directing documentaries on Sammy Davis Jr., the Civil Rights Movement, and the Tulsa Race Massacre of 1921, just to name a few, he's left an indelible mark on the culture over the past 40 years. But his recent output includes MLK FBI, one of the most acclaimed films of the past year that looks into the relationship between Martin Luther King Jr. and the FBI and what we didn't know about their surveillance of the civil rights leader, as well as HBO's film Black Art in the Absence of Light. We recently sat down to chat about this and much, much more.
Well, thank you for joining us. I'm excited to talk about all the different things you have going on. And it's amazing the amount of projects that you have kind of dropping right now. But I think we should begin talking about black art and the absence of light. And I was fascinated by this. You know, I think so many people, you know, 40 odd years later, you know, may not know about the work that David Driscoll, the curator, did by putting this exhibition together. I'm curious, as a starting point, this exhibition, 1976, Two Centuries of Black American Art, did you see that show when it first was up?
No. I live in New York City, and I don't even think, I don't remember it when it was at the Brooklyn Museum. It might have, but I don't remember seeing it at all.
When did this story kind of first come on to your radar? I mean, obviously, you know many of these artists, and it's you know, it's an important story in the history of art history in America. But you know, where did this come into your vision?
Well, initially, the project was taken to HBO by Henry Louis Gates Jr., and he had really wanted to do a documentary that looked at black artists. They hadn't figured out how to do it. And he got Thelma Golden, who runs the Studio Museum, involved. And when I was brought in, about a year and a half later, the first thing we discussed about how to do this film was to center it around Thelma's black male exhibit from 1994 that was at the Whitney. And we approached Thelma about doing that. And she seemed to be reluctant. Well, she was reluctant about approaching it from that perspective. And she was the one who came back and said, you know, maybe you should frame the documentary around this groundbreaking exhibit that was curated by the artist and historian David Driscoll, Two Centuries of Black American Art, that opened at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. And she gave me David's information. I called him up. And I guess I'm going to say in January of 2019, he had a little apartment up on 100th Street in Central Park West, and I went to visit him one evening, and we had dinner together, and we talked about the genesis of Two Centuries and how he became curator, the resistance he faced from the board at that museum about doing the exhibit, but how he was persistent and made it happen. And so after we had that talk and we sort of got to know each other, he seemed to be very comfortable with sort of building the film around that. So we then made the decision that he would go up to his summer house in Portland, Maine, and we would come up there and we would shoot a long interview with him that became sort of the basis for the film, you know. But right before that, after I had that initial meeting with David, he had his own exhibit open at the gallery in Chelsea of his own work. And I went to that, and it was just fantastic to see his own artwork, you know. So that's really sort of how it really came about. It was really Thelma's idea.
Yeah. And is that unusual, that process, for the documentaries that you make, or are you usually working on something for a much longer period of time? Obviously, we're talking about MLK, FBI, which is so reliant on documents and on archival material and research, whereas this has, you know, obviously you're talking to contemporary artists and you're talking to, you know, people that are doing work today, and obviously someone like David who you could interview for the piece.
Every one of these films, they all have their own process. Sometimes you can get the films up and rolling, particularly if you got the funding, you can get them up and rolling in 5-6 months. Sometimes it can take you, you know, a year and a half to get them into a place where you can try to raise the money to do them. You know, sometimes they can take you 2 years to make, 2.5 years. Sometimes they can take 5 years to make. I mean, Black Art in the Absence of Light really took, I would say, I got involved with it at HBO in the fall of 2018. And we finished it, as you know, we finished it only a few weeks ago. So that was almost 2018 to 2019, almost 2.5 years to get this project done, you know. Which, quite honestly, you know, Jeff's pretty fast.
Yeah, I mean... And when you say we, I mean, when you have like 3 or 4 projects going at a time, and from what I'm seeing, it seems like you have even more than that going at a time. Is that a consistent group that you're always working with on that back end, or are you kind of?
No, it changes. It changes over time. You know, I always say, you know, when you're making films, no man is an island. You need collaborators. You need producers. You need camera people, you need a good editing team, you need good archival producers. So you have to have all those things in place. And in my experience, it's changed over time, you know, in terms of the people that you have involved in the project. Now, I have my own company with my partner, Joyce Vaughn. So, you know, we're the basis of this company, but to make things happen, we need to outsource it to other people to sort of help get the projects done.
Yeah. With MLK FBI, you know, what was so fascinating to me was it seems like there was this kind of unspoken secret or truth that, you know, we had heard for so many years that the FBI, and some of that had been known, of course, it was just not to a certain extent that the FBI had had their crosshairs in a literal way, in some ways, on Dr. King. And now with some of the news that just came out this last week about Malcolm X's death and some of the involvement there that was much higher up than people realized, you know, it seems like there's momentum here. Have you been pleased, surprised with the reception of MLK FBI and some of the, it seems like it's created more investigation beyond just what you've done, people looking more into it.
Well, you know, you kind of, you know, in some kind of way, you always hope that your film will touch, you know, the temperature of this country. I mean, when Spike and I did Four Little Girls back in 96, 97, what was amazing how that film alone reopened the investigation and the murders of the Four Little Girls. And so to me, it's been, this is one of the films, another one of these films that, you know, really is sort of a reflection of not only what happened 40 years ago, but it sort of helps you look at what's going on in America today. So it's, my producer, Benadine, and I, we didn't quite know that it would have this kind of impact. We thought it would have some, but it's really had a tremendous impact. over the last 4 or 5 months that I don't think we could have measured.
Well, like you said, timing is it's so important in so many ways. You've been working on this project for a long time, and you didn't expect 2020 to be 2020. And of course, the world changed, you know, in the last year and beyond COVID. But, you know, of course, after the murder of George Floyd and everything that happened there, in some ways, the world was primed even more for this documentary. So timing does seem to play a big factor. Is that
true? It does.
Is that true with every documentary that you put
out? Not really. I mean, you know, you never know. I mean, sometimes you'll finish your film and it doesn't really touch anybody because they say, okay, it was nice. And then you put it away, and then maybe 10 years later, 20 years later, then it starts to resonate. I mean, a great example, quite honestly, you know, Jeff, is Bamboozled. Yes. You know, when Spike directed Bamboozled, which I edited, when that movie came out in 2000, it bombed, man. I remember
this is a film starring Damon Wayans, among other people, that basically takes the minstrel show idea and takes it into the, I guess at that point, the 20th and 21st century, end of the 20th century, 21st century, yeah. And kind of looks at that blackface and all those things. And it was shot on digital, and it was a very controversial film at the time. I remember seeing it when it came out, but also in some ways it kind of was overlooked at that moment. But
it was overlooked. But now, here we are almost 20 years later, and people are saying, wow, it's one of Spike's best films. And it's so relevant, you know? So you never know with these films.
You've touched a couple times on your work with Spike Lee, and you know, I must say I'm a huge fan of that work. You know, Clockers specifically was a hugely important film to me growing up, and Bamboozled, you know, you mentioned that film. In terms of your work as an editor, that film ends with this amazing montage of all the cultural moments. You know, we're talking about animated films, we're talking about other films, you know, touching on blackface and all of that, which is a fairly long sequence, and I'm sure that you spent a lot of time on that. Was that piece, that ending moment, one of the more difficult editorial pieces that you had when you were working with Spike? Because it in some ways is so important to end that film with the gut punch of that montage.
Well, you know, what's interesting was that I think I did like 7 versions of that sequence. And we even tried, when we had screened, had a few test screenings, there was a feeling that we should try to put some contemporary images of blackface or the idea of blackface in it, like from what was the show the Wayans brothers had on back then?
In Living Color.
So we did, and Spike shots, we got some new archival material, we put it in, but somehow that's looking at more contemporary stuff within this context didn't seem to work. And then, you know, I had so many options because we had a wonderful archival producer working on finding material for me, Judy Haley, that I had lots of choices to go back and forth with. And, you know, it was always in the script, the idea of the sequence, not the specifics of it. So it was really, you know, in some ways, an editorial trial and error to try to get it right, to keep moving shots around, to try this element, to move that element, you know. And it was kind of a tough edit because it was... It wasn't like I got it the first time. And you never do when you're editing. You always have to re-edit. And that one took about 4, 5, 6 tries to get it to where it is now. And the only thing that was fascinating to me, you know, Jeff, was when I initially put the last shot in, which is of Savion doing like this.
Yeah, this is Savion Glover, known for great tap dance. Right?
Yes. I, in my own consciousness, I didn't feel his look should be too horrific. So I tried to find a take that was a little softer in his physical expressions, his facial expression. And when I said, screen this version of the cut to Spike and we got that last shot, he said, that's not the shot. That's not the shot, I want a more intense shot. So I went back into the dailies and I found the shot that ends up in the film where he looks like, ooh, a gargoyle to me. You know, I thought it was frightening, but that was the point that Spike was trying to make about blackface, you know.
That's an important film. I hope it drops at some point on one of these streaming platforms and gets rediscovered.
It's on Criterion now.
Yeah, but I think even like a Netflix or something where people be, you know, Criterion thing has got its own, you know, I love Criterion, but something that's a little bit more just like, hey, I could stumble upon it, you know.
It'll be on Netflix. I mean, Spike is a fan, Netflix is a fan of Spike's. They'll put it on there.
Yeah, it's good. To that point, you've done so many documentaries. You know, we're based here in Tulsa, so we've, of course, we'll talk, I think, a little bit about going back to T-Town. We need to talk about that a little bit, but the work that you've done is so varied, but also it's so of a piece. You know, I think if you look at your body of work, you could see that you have a point of view and you have something that you want to say, but you've done feature films with Spike. And then of course you did some documentaries. You mentioned Four Little Girls. Was it you that kind of pushed him in that direction? Because I think early on when you were seeing Spike Lee's work, you wouldn't have expected him to become such a great documentarian. But he's done, you know, of course, When the Levee Breaks and so many other great documentaries. You know, did you work as more of a team on those projects than you had?
Oh, we did. You know, it was an interesting kind of trajectory. I was in California editing a film called Surviving the Game for Ernest Dickerson.
The Ice-T film, yeah.
The Ice-T in Ruckehauer. And I got a script from Spike's producer, John Killick, which was Clockers. And I read the script, Jeff, and I said, yeah, it's okay. But I had done, by the time I had gotten to Surviving the Game, I had done four straight features, Mo Better Blues, Jungle Fever, Juice, and now Surviving the Game. And I was tired of editing feature films. I mean, some editors love cutting features, but me, I wanted to get back to my doc roots. So I was a little tired. So I had said to Killick, you know, it's like a great script, but I'm going to pass. And I fly back to New York after I finished Surviving the Game, and Spike, they sent me another script, and I guess it was an updated version, and Spike asked me if I was interested in doing it, and I said, yeah, I think I'm gonna pass. But then I had this epiphany after I had said this one conversation with Spike. I said, well, if he ever decides to do a documentary, I'd really like to be not only the editor, but co-producer. So I called him and I got his voicemail and I left him a message saying, Spike, I'll edit Clockers only if you let me co-produce with you the first documentary you ever did. Because he hadn't done a doc. He had been talking about trying to do a documentary about Negro League baseball or something. So the next day he called me back and he said, that's a bet, you know. And the Negro League, the baseball thing fell by the wayside, but then all of a sudden, he went to Sheila Nevins at HBO and said he wanted to do this film about the four girls who were killed in the 16th Street Church bombing. And that became Four Little Girls. And, you know, he was very generous. You know, I went on the first shoots to Birmingham. You know, we were very sort of always intricately involved in the process and what he should be shooting and who he should be interviewing and how I thought the structure should. One of the first questions he asked me about Four Little Girls was, should there be a narrator? And I said, no, we should let the people tell the story, you know, which he agreed to. So yeah, it was, you know, he sort of relied on my documentary expertise, you know, and I, as you know, it worked out well for both of us.
Yeah. Well, you know, using that style, that oral history style where you're letting people kind of tell the story for you as opposed to having this voice of God narrator. That's a technique you've used before. You know, let's talk for a second about going back to T-Town. That's a film that was shot in the early 1990s and was released in the early 90s about the Greenwood Black Wall Street neighborhood, about the Tulsa Race Massacre, then called the Tulsa Race
Riot.
That was just re-released. PBS just re-released that. Of course, we're on the centennial year. And this podcast actually is produced in partnership with the Greenwood Art Project. And we're doing a lot of programs with them. Did, you know, 30 odd, almost 30 years after that doc that you dropped, you know, did you have any sense of the resonance of that? Because I remember, I'll just be honest with you. You know, I grew up in Tulsa in 1993 when that came out. I believe it was 93. I was 13 years old, had never heard of that incident happening, which is not a unique story. And you know, you mentioned, you know, I think the, you know, at that point we, you know, you were 70 odd years after the fact. But it wasn't until, you know, later in that decade, in the 90s, after some more books and other films started to come out, that even really got talking. So you were ahead of the curve a lot on that. How did that, you know, I don't want to spend a ton of time on that specific film since it's, you know, it's quite old, but I'm just curious how that happened and what the interest was when there was really no, you know, discussion of it nationally at that time.
Well, initially, Joyce and myself, we were introduced to a woman named Carmen Fields, who grew up in Tulsa, whose father had been a band leader, Ernie Fields, and had a really interesting, what you call, jazz jump band. And she told us a story about her mother was belonged to this ladies club, and they would get together every week, you know, and they would talk about growing up in Tulsa, Oklahoma, back in the 20s and 30s and 40s. And she thought it would be a great documentary. So Joyce and I went to Tulsa, did a scouting trip, met with her mother and met with the ladies and had a nice talk time with them. But we also had found the book about the Tulsa race riot. And we also connected with John Hope Franklin. So we ended up going to Raleigh Durham where John Hope Franklin was teaching, spending a lot of time with him, talking about his father, Buck Franklin, who had been a lawyer for the people who had been dispossessed. And we started to realize that the film should be not just about this ladies club, but should be about the community of the Black community of Tulsa and what they went through, you know, before and during the race riot and after the race riot and what happened to that community when, you know, integration, segregation was sort of dismantled and integration happened. And we were able to find a lot of people, as you see in that film, who lived through that experience, who lived in Tulsa from the 30s and 40s when it was, and we put some ads in the paper and we found this person who had shot all that 16 millimeter footage of the Black community back then. And so it really became, you know, when I rewatched it, we rewatched it a few weeks ago when it came back on TV, and it was, you're right, it's a very important oral history because most of those people are gone.
Yeah, you know, most of those people are gone. The great Ossie Davis who narrated.
Yeah, who narrated. You know, so it's fascinating now, here we go with the 100th anniversary of the Tulsa Race Massacre. And I think there's like five films being made.
Yeah, I believe, and, you know, like Russell Westbrook has a film he's producing.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, I believe another documentary coming.
And Dawn Porter is doing a documentary about it. And what's going to be missing, though, is those voices.
Yeah.
You know, because you don't have those people there. And that's one of the things that, and, you know, I don't think Joyce and I realized, again, how relevant and resonant the film would be after, 20-something years.
Yeah, that's an important film. It's on PBS streaming. If you haven't seen it, anyone who's listening, I would encourage you to check that out. Right. So back to Black art in the absence of light. I'm curious, you know, some documentarians put themselves in their films and kind of become part of the film. That's, I guess, that kind of new journalism thing where, you know, the Errol Morris kind of wing of documentaries. You, like we've talked previously, you know, love to kind of do these kind of almost oral history and have a lot of people telling the story for you. At the same time, do you consider yourself a political filmmaker or an activist filmmaker? I'm sure you've been asked a million times.
No, I don't think of myself as a political filmmaker, an activist filmmaker. I'm a filmmaker, I would say honestly with you, depending on the topic, that has a social conscience. That's how I would describe myself. A filmmaker with a social conscience. You know, I'm a documentary filmmaker. And I would say to you that in the last four or five years, the films that I'm doing, like MLK FBI, or even Black Art, or even my Sammy Davis film, they're speaking to me from the perspective that I lived through these things now. I grew up in the 60s when King was, you know, in front and center in the civil rights struggle. I grew up in the 60s when Sammy Davis Jr. was one of my big heroes, you know, and I didn't know how complicated his life was. I had read his book, Yes, I Can. That's when I started to learn how complicated his life was. So yeah, I'm a documentary filmmaker with hopefully with a social conscience.
Yeah. Well, to that point, you know, some of the people you talk to, some of the artists you talk to, we're about to open a show called From the Limitations of Now, which is a quote taken from the great Ralph Ellison, who was born here in Oklahoma City.
That's right.
And he gave this speech when he returned here. You know, he obviously spent so much time in Harlem, but he came back to Oklahoma City and he gave this speech where he was talking about, you know, in the face of adversity and all these things, he growing up used books and art and other things to, what he said, to free himself from the limitations of today. That was the quote that he kind of used.
That's a great line.
Which is powerful. And many of the artists you feature in this documentary are in this show, specifically Betty Saar, specifically Faith Ringgold. And Faith Ringgold plays such a big role in the last half century or beyond. And her role in the film, I think, was fascinating because she's kind of unlike anybody else. And, you know, I asked you if you're an activist or political, and you said no. She, I think, would very much say she definitely overtly is. What was it like spending some time and getting to know her a little bit?
She's, you know, I had done a segment with her back in 1998 for this documentary series, one of the last documentary series that Henry Hampton executive produced, called I'll Make Me a World, about artists and culture and the African-American experience. And we had shot Faith up at her apartment at the time on 145th Street. And she's always, you know, as you can see in this film, she's always feisty and direct, you know. And one of the great moments to me in Black Art is her talking about how the guys in Spiral rejected her, you know, and how she got that note from Romare Beard, and, you know, and that she was an actor, she was a feminist. And even her daughter Michelle is like that too. So she's a pleasure, you know. She always puts it out there.
Yeah,
she doesn't hold back.
Well, and it's so important, you know. One of the things I love about this documentary, you talk to so many people from, you know, other people, like, for example, like Theaster Gates, who we have in our collection, or, you know, Amy Sherald, some of the kind of, you know, middle-aged, even younger artists, and Jordan Castile, who I really enjoyed hearing from. But some of the older artists, of course, much like we talked about for going back to T-Town, you've documented these people. They're not going to be around forever, and it's going to be...
Richard Mayhew and Faith.
Yeah, and of course, David Driscoll, you know.
And David Driscoll, yeah. You
know? So that... you know, giving those people kind of immortality on, I guess I was going to say celluloid, but, you know, in the digital space is so important. Yeah. As we wrap up here, I'd like to finish talking about MLK FBI a bit. I'm curious, when you take someone as revered as MLK, and of course, throughout this process, you're of course indicting the FBI for the work they did, but you're also, you know, telling some things about Martin Luther King Jr. that people may not know before, and some of the more, I guess I would say, human instincts of someone like Dr. King. And mm-hmm. to me, that very much humanizes him and takes him from an untouchable godlike status and says, hey, normal people have foibles, but they can also achieve amazing things. You know, did you feel any
reservations?
Yeah, reservations about tarnishing.
Sure, man, sure, because, you know, I was saying last night on something I was doing that in my household in the 60s, if you walked into my family's living room, we had three images on our wall, Jeff. Martin Luther King Jr., John Fitzgerald Kennedy, and Jesus Christ. Yeah. You know, that was sort of the Holy Trinity. And back when I was 14, 15 years old, and I was 18 and when Dr. King was assassinated, I had turned 18 2 days before his assassination. He was revered, you know. I didn't think anymore that, except he was the general who had the I Have a Dream speech and he was going to take us to the promised land. You know, so, but here I am 40 years later and I'm a much more cynical, complicated human being. And, you know, and as much as I still love and revere Dr. King, you said it very clearly. He didn't walk on water. He was a human being with his flaws. And to me, that's part of the challenge when you make these films now, when you're looking at, you know, people who were my heroes, Sammy Davis, August Wilson, Dr. King. I'm trying to paint a picture, hopefully, that shows them as human beings, you know, who did great things. That's the point. We
the same. Boy, you can't make it, cause the fever man is in your way. No more tears do we cry, and we have finally dried our eyes. We're moving on up, moving on up. Lord have mercy, we're moving on.
Well, that's our show for this week. Our program is produced and edited by Jack Dean. Museum Confidential is a co-production of Philbrick Museum of Art, Public Radio Tulsa, and the Greenwood Art Project. To learn more about the museum, the station, and the project, visit philbrick.org, publicradiotulsa.org, or greenwoodartproject.org. Or visit all of them. We suggest all of them. Until next time, look closer.